Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Hi, everyone. This is the Rose Colombo.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hey, welcome, everyone. We have a great show for you today, and today we have a very special guest. His name is David Hofstad. And he is a multi-talented author. He's celebrating the success of a very important book we can all relate to, When Television Brought Us Together. And he'll be reviewing the major TV shows of the past decades and the values that shaped America's first television viewing generations. This book is truly a study of the impact that TV made on our nation. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about David Hofstad in just a moment. But first, I wanted to touch on a couple issues of the day, which include Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris has been very, very busy traveling around and making generous donations of cookies to the journalists who travel with her. And this article is from the Patriot Journal. It says, Kamala Harris hands out eye-raising cookies to reporters. They're in the shape of the vice president's faceless head. So that should put a smile on your face to start things off for the day and get you going. It says, how vain is Kamala Harris? Well, not long ago, she and her staff were outraged over the picture Vogue used on their cover. Apparently it wasn't professional enough. Hey, she was one who wore sneakers to a photo shoot, if you remember that. But that is just the tip of the iceberg for a Democrat who is apparently all appearances, zero substance, it says. The media is making much of her visit to Central America this week. Nothing good has come out so far, except perhaps this little weird episode. Before leaving, she handed out cookies to the reporters. That was a very generous thing to think and thoughtful. However, it goes on to say, odd enough, right? But wait, they were of her head, minus the face. Users on Twitter roasted Vice President Harris for passing out cookies made in her likeness to reporters on a plane while traveling to meet with the president of Guatemala. In the trail of Air Force Two, though Harris handed out cookies in her likeness, faceless likeness, made in the style of her official White House portrait, handing out cookies with her face on them, well, faceless face on them as the border crisis rages, McDaniel wrote, the modern-day equivalent to let them eat cake. And that was the response there. And it was interesting because over in Guatemala, she's had quite a week, according to WND. Guatemalans tell Kamala Harris to go home. Trump won. On Sunday, Vice President Kamala Harris made her first official trip abroad as a member of the Biden administration. Her travels led her south to Guatemala, where she is supposed to be working out solutions to root causes of the illegal immigration crisis at the United States-Mexico border. Evidently, some Guatemalans weren't happy to see Vice President Kamala Harris. When she descended the steps of Air Force Two, Harris was greeted by a crowd of protesters outside the airport, many of them pro-Donald Trump activists flashing signs that read, "Kamala, mind your own business. Kamala, go home. And Kamala, Trump won." And they have a photo of all the protesters with their signs held up high. Given the Biden administration's coddling of illegal immigrants, the article says, this was probably came as quite a surprise to the Vice President Kamala Harris. But it also goes on to say, and its willingness to funnel cash to any country that claims need, you would have expected Harris to have been met with pro-illegal immigration signs and fawning pro-Biden activists. So those are the exciting things happening in the news with our Vice President Kamala Harris this week. She's had quite a tough time, I would say, with her faceless cookies passed out to reporters and then her descent upon the Guatemalans. But, you know, that's what happens when you're a public official, right? You never know what's coming next, and you got to be ready to handle it in a professional way. So passing out cookies was her way of saying thank you, I suppose. And on that note, we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts, my favorite part of the show. And as I stated before, our special guest is David Hofstede. And that's spelled H-O-F, like Frank, S like Sam, T like Tom, E-D-A, Hofstede. And this multi-talented author is now celebrating the success of an important book, as I said before, and it is entitled When Television Brought Us Together. This is going to be fun because we're going to be reviewing the major TV shows of the past with David Hofstede and past decades as well, and the values that shaped America's first television viewing generations. So this book is truly a study, as I stated, on the impact that TV made on the United States of America. And there is so much we can learn from the book. It's a look back at early television in the United States, what made television so successful, where is television heading in the opinion of the author, and who is also the creator of Comfort TV blog. A true student of pop culture over the years, David Hofstede is also the author of such bestsellers on TV as What Were They Thinking? And The 100 Dumbest Events in Television History and Obsessed with TV. And so why don't we just welcome David to our show and let's get started and let's say hello to David Hofstede on Colombo Chronicles Live. Hi, David. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Rose. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. We have a beautiful day here in California today, and it made me so happy. There's a little breeze, and it's a little sunshine and blue skies and some white clouds, and that made my day.
Well, that's great. I'm calling you from Las Vegas, where we're headed towards 110 degrees for about the next 3 months. But
see, you
we're
need
used
to come
to that
California
by now.
I've been to Vegas many times, and I used to travel there on also as well as for entertainment in between. But for the beauty industry, they held their conferences there, and all their new products were shown, and it was an equipment, and it was really exciting. But one time it was like 113. I thought I was going to melt.
Yeah, that takes some getting used to.
Well, we're really happy you joined us today, David Hofstede, because, you know, everyone's interested in what's happening with television because we've entered into the new world of AI and social media and so many more things. So to begin with, can you tell our audience why you became so intrigued in the history of television?
Yeah, I've always been a writer. I had my first book published back when I was in college, which was back in the early 1980s, and all of my interest tended toward pop culture. So I reviewed movies for National Public Radio for a while, and then as those interests tended to coalesce more and more about television, I noticed that even though years and decades were passing, I found myself still watching a lot of the same television shows that I grew up watching, and those were the ones primarily in the 1970s when I was young, but of course at that time the shows from the 1950s and 60s were still being broadcast pretty regularly in syndication, so there was a lot of exposure to all of those classics as well. And as book publishing has changed over the years, I decided that it was better to kind of get those thoughts out on a blog. And that's what I started. It's called Comfort TV. It started back in 2012. And originally it was just supposed to be a place to share those thoughts about a lot of those great shows. And then over the years, I began to think a little bit more about why so many people like me still prefer to watch those shows that are 40 to 50 years old to all the new shows available. Obviously, they were great shows, and they're shows you can watch with your kids without worrying about the content. But I thought it had to be a little more than that. And I think the answer is that those shows, from our perspective now, they provide sort of a window into what life in America was like at the time when they were created. So without banging you over a head with a strong message, they were showing you that this is what schools were like, and this is what families were like, this is how people related to each other, and these were the lessons that parents thought were important to deliver to their children about values and patriotism and honesty. And to many of us who are old enough to remember those times, in a lot of ways they seemed a lot better than what we have now. And so that's what inspired the book, as a way to not just celebrate the shows, but also to look back with some fondness at the era in which they took place.
Oh, I agree with you 100%, because my kids and grandkids, they love all those old classics. I got them involved, and they love them. They love the movies. They love all the old stories. I Love Lucy, Leave It to Beaver, all of those. They just love them. And they're fascinated with the clothing and the cars and the houses and the way the families ate together at dinner. And just
without all looking at their cell phones and texting each other around the dinner table.
And going to church on Sunday, a lot of those movies had people going to church on Sunday and dressed up and going out to dinner, and they dressed up. They didn't dress down. And kids dressed for school properly, or they were sent home. I mean, you could see it all, and I agree with you. I believe those are part of our history, and they should definitely be preserved. So I'm excited that you wrote your book, and When Television Brought Us Together. And so tell me, what was your first television show that you were excited about when you got your first television in your home?
Oh, gosh. I think as most children of the 70s, we grew up with the Brady Bunch. And I have some very dim memories of watching that first run. So that would be about 1970, 71. I was 6 or 7 years old. And, of course, like a lot of the shows from that time, it was canceled after 5 seasons, but it never really went away. It just seemed to play forever and ever and ever in reruns. And then there were revivals and movies bringing the cast back together, and there have been feature films since then and books and animated shows. And just a couple of years ago, you may have read about HGTV purchasing the home that was shown at the beginning of every episode. That was ostensibly where the Brady family lived. Of course, they never shot the show there. That was just an establishing shot of the home. And they purchased it and spent several million dollars renovating the inside so it would look exactly like how the show looked on television that we all remembered. So for something to have that great of a pop culture impact 50 years after it debuted, it kind of shows you the power of television and how closely connected it is to so many of our memories.
That's so true, and I when you said the Brady Bunch, I still the song popped right in my head.
Yeah. And the opening credits with the boxes, everybody said that was the precursor to Zoom calls from last year, looking at all these faces in these different boxes.
Well, yeah. David, it's a different world now. So do you think television plays the same role in people's lives as it used to in the past? And do you think anything's been lost?
Yeah, I certainly don't think it does. I mean, how often do people now, if they're in an office together or they're at a party and they all talk about a TV show that they all watched the previous night? And that really doesn't happen very much anymore because most of us have 400 channels and streaming services and we're all watching different things at different times. So even the shows that are considered the most popular on a lot of cable and streaming services, they're being watched maybe by less than 1% of the total population. In fact, I think there have probably been countless shows over the past couple of decades that have debuted and disappeared with most of us completely unaware of their existence. You know, and for most of its history, that's not how television worked. The shows that are featured in the book come from a time when we all just had three national networks. There was no cable, there was no streaming, there was no internet, and because of that, television was a much more prominent source of information and entertainment, and in a lot of cases, all of us were watching the same shows. So, and again, that's where the title came from. It's a celebration of the time when television brought us together in a way that, unfortunately, really isn't capable of doing anymore. And I think it's just one of those common threads of a culture that we once had that have disappeared over the last few decades, and I think that's a very sad thing.
I do too. My dad, I mean, after dinner, he always watched the 6 o'clock news. I mean, that was major television shows, you know.
Yes.
Had great anchors. I mean, seriously, you look back at them now, you know, I was looking back at some that my dad watched, and I was like, they really did have really good information for people, you know, and it wasn't all doom and gloom either.
No, it was somewhat ironic that you could watch just 1/2 hour of news a day at that time and be better informed than you would be by watching some of the 24-hour cable news networks that we have now, because they have to fill all of that time with so much content that is constantly repeated and repeated and repeated throughout the day. And that can, I think it can end up giving you a false impression of what the country is all about, and that, you know, we're defined by the worst of those experiences instead of the best of them. And I think news consumed in a much narrower prism is ultimately a much better thing. And we should also say that back then the news was more objectively presented, it was more honestly presented. And even though some of the anchors may have had strong political views one way or another, that really didn't come through when they were telling the country what was going on. And that was certainly a much better thing than what we have now.
And they were really respected, too.
Yes, they were. They were at one time, Walter Cronkite was probably the most respected person in the country and certainly one of the most trusted. And it was nice when journalism held that position in the nation. It certainly doesn't do so anymore, in my opinion.
No, people are just being entertained in a lot of instances, and then other people who are not journalists or anchors or reporters, they're making their own shows with their own information, and so the sources are coming from every which way, and people are very confused today.
It's very difficult to tell what we consider a legitimate source of information from just someone posting on Facebook, because they all kind of look the same now when we're at the computer. And sad times. That again, you know, when TV was the only screen in the house, it was giving us a lot more reliable and entertaining content than what we're getting today. Sometimes more is not automatically better.
No, and television, actually, we only had one television in our home when I was growing up, and it was in the living room. So everyone gathered in the living room to watch certain shows, you know. And and it really did, I think, help bring families together, because there was only one television. So if you wanted to watch a show, everybody had to go to the same living room to watch it, you know, unless you were a teenager and went to your friend's house.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and they had a more defined season then. I mean, I remember September was always the month where we had to go back to school, so that wasn't any fun, but it was also when all the new shows debuted every year. And I don't know if your family got the big TV Guide fall preview issue every year that had all the information about the new shows that were coming, and we'd see something that looked really interesting and then find out it was on at the same time as something we'd been watching and enjoying for years. And of course, a lot of this was before we even had video cassette recorders, you know, much less DVRs and all the stuff that we have now. So we had some very difficult choices to make back then. But, of course, that was part of the fun of it. You know, the programs were special. You know, if you really loved a show and it was only going to be on Saturday nights at 8 o'clock, you had to be home Saturday nights at 8 o'clock to watch it, or you were going to miss it. And people did rearrange their schedules to watch the shows that they loved. And, of course, now none of that is really necessary anymore, and in some ways that's a good thing. But I think when you can do something whenever you want, it's not as special to be able to do it. And that's another element of TV that's been lost over the years.
And also game shows were very popular.
They sure were, and there's even some networks now that are showing the old game shows from the 70s and 80s, so to watch the old Price is Rights and Sale of the Centuries and all of those shows. Yeah, those really dominated the mornings, weekday mornings. I remember a lot of days staying homesick from school and watching Bob Barker on the Price is Right. And another happy memory.
I actually go back on YouTube, and I actually watch a lot of the old shows from the past, and they're so funny and fun, and it was clean fun. It was just, and I'm laughing my head off, and my kids, what are you laughing at, you know? And then I tell them, and they'll go in their room and sneak it and look, and they'll be like, wow.
Yeah, and it's nice you said your kids and grandkids are, you know, you're getting into those shows now, and that's great. And I think a lot of that is happening, but it's a little under the radar, because I think the overarching viewpoint right now is that these shows from 50, 60 years ago are very dated, that they're not as they don't reflect the way we live now, which in some ways is true, but I think that's a good thing and not a bad thing. And I think a lot of modern audiences might really turn off from them because of that. But if they took the time to really watch something, even something that goes as far back as The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet from the early 50s, they would find these shows are surprisingly contemporary in a lot of ways, and families, you know, still have a lot of the same problems now that they did back then. And the writing was so sharp and funny, and the characters that they played were so interesting that I think they would find they enjoy a lot of that stuff more than they would think so.
It's true, because my kids and grandkids, they say, I wish I could have lived back then, you know.
Yeah.
They do. They say that, you know. I wish things were like that now, you know, because there's so much pressure on young people in the sexual world here. Everything's about sex and violence, and not everything, but I mean, there's a lot of it, you know, and pressure on these young kids, you know, and they don't get to be kids like we got to be kids. And I think that's sad. And I think, you know, watching these old shows, I think should be a requirement in elementary school and junior high.
Yeah, and you know, not to get too big and profound and philosophical about this, but there was a positive worldview that came through in these shows. I mean, one of the chapters in my book is called A Default Setting of Kindness. And I think that's where a lot of these shows emanated from. I mean, these were good people, and they answered their telephone and their doorbell, you know, with a smile, not that it was this terrible interruption in their lives, and they were happy to have the jobs that they had. You know, work was something that they were proud to do and that they celebrated. And as you said earlier, church on Sunday was the rule and not the exception. And those messages still come through on these shows. And, you know, I don't know what your views are on Jordan Peterson, but I think one of the reasons he's become something of a phenomenon is that his books reinforce some basic truths that once seemingly all of us knew, but now it seems fewer people understand because they're no longer taught and because the places that still teach them, like our houses of worship, are not, unfortunately, as well attended as they used to be. And that's another reason for the enduring appeal of these shows. They teach those lessons by example. And you will get stories that have a very straightforward, clear moral at the end, but sometimes they just show you the remarkable nobility of the country and how our society is organized and all the things we've accomplished are shown through the way those characters live their everyday lives. It doesn't have to be a heavy-handed civics lesson to get that message across. And we may not always be aware of it as we're watching those shows, but I think some of that still sinks in.
Oh, it does. It absolutely does, and that's why I think it's so important to preserve them. And, you know, they have this new cancel culture where they want to cancel everything, but that's our history, and that really is the American way that, you know, people lived in Americanism why we were so successful in everything we were doing, because we appreciated things. I don't know about you, but if I were to ask my parents for something, you know, they would be like, well, do some chores and save some of the money, you know. And
It
wasn't like, here you go, here's, you know, $100 or whatever. No way, they would have laughed at me.
Yeah, we really tend to view history now with a very judgmental eye. You know, it seems like the only reason to study previous centuries is to observe everything that everybody did wrong from our modern day perspective. And you know, these shows are an acknowledgement that such a simplistic view of history really is inadequate. You know, and like I said, they're a window. I mean, you look at some of these shows and you're really seeing a window of how people lived 50 or 60 years ago. And, you know, there's some aspects of our society, certainly, that we're happy have changed since that time, but we don't need to throw all of it out. There was a lot of good that was there that should be preserved, and television, thankfully, is one way that we're able to do that.
Yes, and a lot of the movies showed and the TV series, if you, you know, watch them, like I watch them all the time when I can.
Yeah.
and I love how people helped each other. The neighbors knew each other. You needed this, you needed that. They were there for you if you're sick, whatever. I mean, people cared about people and they knew each other in their communities. Today, most people don't even know their neighbors.
You know,
so it's a different world.
There's a chapter in the book about Johnny Carson and the 30 years that he hosted The Tonight Show. And it's a very interesting contrast to how that show was put on versus how the late night talk shows of today are put together. because when Johnny Carson did his monologues, if the Democrats were running the country, that's where the jokes were. And then if the Republicans were running the country, then that's where the jokes were. It was a nonpartisan approach to humor. You looked at what was happening in the country, and you found something funny in it. And now, I mean, all of the late night shows, They're very specific in their point of view, and they're very one-sided in their commentary and their humor. And you think, well, why alienate half of your audience before you even give them a chance to watch you? And of course, that's reflected in the ratings for these shows as well, that half the country really isn't interested in what they have to say.
No, we're not interested when we're looking at a show that, you know, if you're going to compare it to Johnny Carson, he was just funny. And no matter
yes.
which side he was on, you didn't really realize he was on any side, actually. And he just
exactly.
kind of stayed, you know, in the middle and let the guest, you know, make the comments that were usually extremely funny. And even today, I crack up. I'm just like, oh, my God,
yeah.
these comedians were so hilarious. I can't even, you know. And so we're talking to David Hofstede. He wrote the book, When Television Brought Us Together. And so, David, the book suggests that the era in which these shows aired was a better one than what we have today. But the 1960s were tumultuous. We all know that, the hippie age,
mm-hmm.
Woodstock, drugs, all these different things. But that was a minority of people going on in the colleges. And the rest of the people, the kids, were still not into that new tumultuous decade. But there were communes going on. And, of course, it began to spread over the years, this liberalism. So what is it that do you think was that a better era, or do you think it changed the way television began to produce different types of shows and news?
I think, you know, when you're talking about that, it's obviously everybody has their thoughts. Who was around at the time about Vietnam and about the government and
right.
the things that were current events back then. But unless you were watching, say, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In or the Smothers Brothers shows, you really weren't confronted with those issues every time you turned on the TV. As we talked earlier, you got your news, national news, in a half hour a night from Walter Cronkite or David Brinkley. And then when it was time to relax for an evening of television, you had some shows that really didn't draw upon current events as part of their stories. And I think that's why we can still watch the Dick Van Dyke Show or Bewitched or any of these shows today and still be entertained by them, because they're not constantly referencing who's in the White House and what was going on in the streets of Chicago or New York or any of those types of situations. And I think a lot of the TV that's on now is going to look awfully dated in 20 or 30 years, because it's going to be referencing news stories and news events that people will have long forgotten. The other aspect of that is it's nice not to be confronted with all that stuff every time you turn on the TV. And we really don't have that luxury anymore with internet and 24-hour news. We're bombarded with negative images dozens, if not hundreds of times a day. And, you know, there's always been political and social divides in the country, but in the 1960s, television largely provided an escape from that reality instead of adding to all of the hostility. And, you know, that's not ignoring history. That's just saying, you know, when you watch a family getting along and going about their daily lives, that's who we really are. I mean, this is how most of us live or would prefer to live, and maybe we should spend a little more time focusing on that and not what divides us.
I agree, and I think all this pitting people against, you know, gays and heterosexuals and blacks and browns and white, I think that's so negative because most people don't really care what you're doing if you're two consenting adults in your bedroom. Nobody really cares. They have their own issues going on in their lives.
No, of course.
And the government turns this into such a big negative for everybody. And, I think people just care about people, you know, and they're making all these things so negative. And, it's so ridiculous. We're all Americans, and bottom line is when things happen, Americans have always united in the past to try to save our country. And that's what this government should be focusing on when it comes to television and social media, bringing people together. And so, David, I love what you've done. And so, what do you want your readers to take away from your book?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I hope it brings back a lot of happy memories of a lot of shows that we all grew up watching. Maybe if you haven't watched some of the 50 shows that are profiled in the book, it'll inspire you to track them down. I'm sure they're playing somewhere in the TV universe today, so they'll be easy to find. Maybe start some debates about what the best episodes were, because those are selected for each of the shows that were profiled. And I also hope it provides them with a bit of a respite from the craziness of the 21st century, particularly in this past year. I mean, if all the political turmoil weren't enough, we had a pandemic on top of it that disrupted all of our lives. And hopefully the book will serve as a reminder of what the country and what we all used to be like before we got to this crazy point. I mean, we certainly need a temporary escape once in a while from our stressful times, and that's what the TV shows provided, and I hope that's what the book provides as well.
Yeah, 2 years of this pandemic is 2 years too long.
Enough is enough.
Enough is enough. Let's move on.
Well, you're in California. You got the worst of a lot of those lockdowns.
Lord, I even have Governor Newsom asking for $3 now to save his save him from the call. I go, no, that's really sad.
Well, good luck with that, Governor. You're going to need it.
It's really funny, though. I got to save that article. You know, I save things like that. I'm like, oh, can you believe this when you go back 10 years and you're like, holy smoke.
That may be a lot of the cases, on a lot of stuff.
You can always use them for a book or something, you know.
There you go.
Do you remember when the governor asked me for $3? And he's a multimillionaire. I should send him a letter and ask him for $3.
Exactly.
I'm sorry I had to be to get up and all that, but
that's all right. Hopefully he'll have more time on his hands soon to answer all that correspondence.
So, David, how is it that your listeners, our listeners, can purchase your book?
Oh, it's available on Amazon.com. It's available at BarnesandNoble.com, and it's also available through my blog, which is called Comfort TV, and that's at Comfort TV at Blogspot, BlogSpot.com.
Very good. And what's your next literary project?
Oh, God, Rose, I don't know. You know, when I was younger, I cranked out about 15 books on television and pop culture, and publishing has changed so much since then. But the blog sort of reinvigorated that interest, and I kind of wanted to talk about a lot of things, not just about TV, but things that were going on in the country and how we've all changed since that classic TV era. And this was the book that did it. So for the next couple of years anyways, I think I'll just be focusing on the blog. So if people like to talk about those shows and read about those shows, Comfort TV is the place to go to get my thoughts on that.
That's perfect. And so Lastly, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the interview, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure the audience has too. In your opinion, what is the state of today's TV in America as you see it, and what is your prediction of TV in the future?
You know, I don't really watch a lot of current TV, and the shows I have watched from time to time, you know, we've kind of touched on this already. They seem determined to advance an agenda that is not one that I particularly share. Now, whether doing that proves detrimental to the medium ultimately, I really don't know. I guess it depends on how many people share that agenda. You know, the facts that millions of folks still prefer watching the older shows to the current ones suggest that maybe they feel a lot more at home in the world as it was then than the world that we're in now. And I guess I would have to say I'm definitely in that category and guilty as charged. But, you know, because TV tends to come and go, new shows without many people knowing about it, or they watch it and then it's not that big of a deal to them. I mean, when television was a central source of entertainment and news, that was it occupied an important position in all of our lives. And now, to me, a new TV show is sort of like a YouTube video. You know, you'll watch it once and maybe be entertained for a few minutes, and then it sort of disappears from your memory. And it's kind of sad, but I think that's where TV is, and it's probably headed further down that path in the future.
That's so sad too, and because, you know, TV is a great communication source to spread, you know, the real America out there and try to teach young people to go back to the norm of what America is and respect America and love America and embrace America, because we're the only really free nation in the whole world.
Yeah.
And we need to preserve that. So I think television, you know, writing about television is very important, and I'm so glad you did. And I'm with you, though. I turn them off and I'm watching the old classics. That's who I watch, and I don't have time to listen to garbage, to tell you the truth.
As I said in the book about the show Dragnet, I said, you know, what would Sergeant Joe Friday think of Sanctuary City? We're in such a different world now.
I just loved him. It was so, you know, oh, gosh, great.
Yeah.
You know, the writers, too, you know, David, the writers, they had and turns in their movies. You know, if you watch the old classic movies, you're like, wow, I didn't expect that, you know? And they had so much, you know, Alfred Hitchcock and all these different brilliant producers, directors, and writers. They're not making those same human interest stories anymore that keep you on the edge of your seat without a bunch of, you know, violence, gross violence, and in-your-face sex. You know, it was so mysterious.
Yeah.
You know, they would have the bedroom scene and the lady was in her negligee and, you know, and then they'd shut the door. Well, you knew it was going to happen, you know.
There was a document put out, called The Code of Practices for Television Broadcasters, and I talk about that in the book. And it was a code that started in 1952 and was enforced through the early 70s, and it's just four simple typewritten pages of guidelines that all the networks followed. And I'm reading it now, it just seems so antiquated when you look at the way television is, but it talked about how television needs to be a guest in people's home. And I don't think any of us think about television as being a guest in our home anymore. So, you know, it would be nice if we could still think about it that way.
I am so glad you shared that, because that's how I try to present my podcast. I used to be AM, FM radio shows, and I always tried to present my podcast as these are my guests, and if they were in my home, I want to treat them just as if they would treat me if I was in their home. And I think that what you just said about television, they are coming into your home, and you are inviting them in your home to watch their programs. And they should be more aware that this is a family and in the home, and they should be more aware of what they're seeing and doing in their presentations. And more people would watch them, and in the future they would become classics too, that future generations would continue to teach their kids to watch and their grandkids as well. So I agree with you 100%, David Hofstede, and thank you so much for your book, When Television Brought Us Together. I hope everyone gets a copy because they will learn about what real television and real America and real news and real anchors were really about in the past. And you walked away with a good feeling. You didn't turn it off with a bad feeling in your mouth or have a nightmare.
That's for sure. Didn't have to mute the commercials because they were talking about things you didn't want talked about.
Well, God bless you. And you know, keep us informed of any new books that you come up with. And we'll check out your blog as well.
Thank you, Rose. Certainly. I appreciate you having me on today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You
bye
too.
Bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And David Hofstede has left the building, and you will be so happy if you go out and get When Television Brought Us Together, because it will, if you're mature and you were, around when television first came in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, before the new millennium, and you saw all those wonderful, wonderful TV shows and series and game shows and real news anchors with real news, and they didn't bore you and go on and on and on with doom and gloom, but they came up with just the news, and then you made your decision on the issues that they presented. And so, and then you turned it on to maybe a game show or a movie or a TV series, and there was always human interest, or you were laughing like with Johnny Carson. My goodness, if you're young and you've never seen a Johnny Carson show, you should actually go on YouTube and check it out, and you will be laughing your head off too. It is so, the guests are so funny. And so was Johnny Carson. And so, you know, just check out this book because you will learn a lot, and you will go and check out these old classic movies and TV shows and have a good feeling about America. And on that note, we're going to take a break, and we're going to enter into the world of politics. So do not touch that dial.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up to Columbo Chronicles Live. We just left the world of authors and experts with a wonderful guest and author, David Hofstede. And you can get his book on Amazon or at his website. His book is entitled When Television Brought Us Together. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. And on that note, we're going to talk about an article, and it's on AlGore.com. And you need to know this. WHO and CDC, the new Nuremberg Trials 2021. Dr. Rainer Fulmick, Crimes Against Humanity. This is about our lives and our bodies. These are brave doctors. The new Nuremberg trials of 2021. A team of over 1,000 lawyers and over 10,000 medical experts, led by Dr. Rainer Fulmick, F-U-L-L-M like Mary, I-C-H, have begun legal proceedings over the CDC, WHO, the Davos Group for Crimes Against Humanity. Fulmick and his team present the faulty PCR test, the swab that's made in China that they stick up your nose to your brain. That's the PCR test. And the order for doctors to label any comorbidity death as a COVID death as a fraud. Remember, there were articles stating that they were providing financial incentive. This is not in the article. These are other articles. That they were providing financial incentive to hospitals and nursing homes for every test that they recorded as positive COVID, for every patient as a COVID patient, and for every death that they would record as a COVID death, despite if they died from a car accident, a heart attack, a stroke, blood clots, diabetes, drug overdose, it didn't matter. Tens of thousands of dollars were paid for these recordings on the medical records or on a death record. The CDC, the article says, admits that any test over 28 cycles are not admissible for any positive reliable result. This alone invalidates over 90% of the alleged COVID infections tracked by the use of this faulty test. Personally, I've always said, why would we want a swab stuck up our nose, feeling like it's gone up to our brain, made in China, when they unleashed the biochemical weapon on the world, and which means they want to dominate the world, and they've always wanted to dominate America. And how much easier to dominate a nation and conquer it if there are fewer people in that particular nation, or dominate the world if there are fewer people, especially those who are non-compliant to communism, socialism, and to obeying the government and worshiping the government and the leader as their God. And eliminating God from the planet and eliminating the Bible and eliminating Christianity, eliminating Israel, eliminating Jews, Catholics, blacks, gays, anyone they dislike. They could eliminate them. Anyway, this particular article says, in addition to the flawed tests and fraudulent death certificates, experimental vaccine, and, you know, excuse me, but the news keeps saying, if you want to call it news, stating that people need to be vaccinated. They need this vaccination. They must get this vaccination. They're bordering on mandating this vaccination. It is an experiment. It is a trial. They are using human beings as guinea pigs for an experimental and trial by Big Pharma, CDC, WHO, public servants involved, who may be invested in Big Pharma, as Bill Gates is invested in Big Pharma, and he's invested $10 billion, according to his own words, and expects a $200 billion return on his investment. But that's why he said everyone must be vaccinated or you have no choice. What do you mean we have no choice? We're Americans. We live in America. Hello? We have a constitution. It's called the United States Constitution. It's the supreme laws of the land. This is a republic. We have laws that secure the borders. Why are they open? Why are they denying us freedom, liberty, rights, the right to work, which are the laws on the necessities of life? They cannot deny human beings the right to work, to sustain their lifestyle, and to provide for themselves and their families the necessities of life. It's the law in America. They cannot deny you the right to be imprisoned in your home for 2 years and not leave your home, not be near your family, your friends, your neighbors. This is insanity. 99.9% recovery rate. Yeah, there's cures, like, according to the doctors, ivermectin, remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, which even Dr. Fauci said cured COVID, in newspaper articles. Why did Facebook suspend me for publishing that newspaper article? I didn't make it up. It's a newspaper article. So anyway, this is all insanity. It's craziness for control. Depopulation, possibly. Hello? Because by 2050, the New World Order seeks to have reduced the population by 90%. It's wiping out almost everybody. It would be a worldwide mass murder, a worldwide mass genocide. And they, according to Gavos and Bill Gates, they intend to reduce carbon monoxide by 90%. By 100% by 2050. That means eliminating the cows, the birds, the animals, and humans in order to reduce the carbon monoxide at 100% by 2050. So anyway, this particular article says, in addition to the flawed tests and fraudulent death certificates, the experimental vaccine itself is in violation of Article 32 of the Geneva Convention. Under Article 32 of the 1949 Geneva Convention for mutilation and medical or scientific experiments not necessitated by the medical treatment of a protected person are prohibited. According to Article 147, conducting biological experiments on protected person is a grave breach of. What about Article 4? Doesn't Article 4 state that if a person fears being assaulted, whether it be physically or with a weapon, and a needle is a weapon, because it is chemically laden with a myriad of chemicals, such as ethanol or aluminum, lead, barium. It could be anything. Mercury. That could have serious adverse effects on the body, such as paralysis, sterility, depression, suicidal tendencies, or death, or more. So the Fourth Amendment, doesn't that protect us if we are fearful of a assault on our bodies? And don't we have the right to resist and say no under the United States Constitution Bill of Rights? This article says the experimental vaccine is in violation of all 10 of the Nuremberg Codes, which carry the death penalty for those who seek to violate these intentional laws. The vaccine fails to meet the following 5 requirements to be considered a vaccine, and by definition, a medical experiment and trial. So you are a guinea pig. You are their property. You are they're using us as commodities, human commodities for profit and human capital. They're using us as experiments and trials, which makes us guinea pigs. It makes us their property and their chattel, and gives us no rights to say no. We do not want to be used as an experiment and for your trials, for your profit and human capital. It provides immunity to the virus. This is a leaky gene therapy that does not provide immunity to COVID and claims to reduce symptoms, yet double vaccinated are now 60% of the patients requiring ER or ICU with COVID infections. And I have a family member, and I know of people who, after the 2 jabs, ended up in the ICU or ended up very, very ill or died. Protects recipients from getting the virus. This gene therapy does not provide immunity, and double vaccinated can still catch and spread the virus. Reduces deaths from the virus infection. This gene therapy does not reduce deaths from the infection. Double vaccinated infection with COVID have also died. Reduces circulation of the virus. This gene therapy still permits the spread of the virus, as it offers zero immunity to the virus. Reduces transmission of the virus. This gene therapy still permits the transmission of the virus, as it offers zero immunity to the virus. The following violations of the Nuremberg Code is as follows. Nuremberg Code number 1, voluntary consent is essential. No person should be forced to take medical experiment without informed consent. Many media, political, and non-medical persons are telling people to take the shot. It's safe and offer no information as to the adverse effects, and I want to say direct adverse effects, or dangers of this gene therapy to that person. Countries are using lockdowns, duress, and threats to force people to take this vaccine or be prohibited to participate in free society under the mandate of a vaccine passport or green pass. During the Nuremberg trial, even the media was prosecuted and members were put to death for lying to the public, amongst many of the doctors and Nazis found guilty of crimes against humanity. As listed above, the gene therapy does not meet the criteria of a vaccine and does not offer immunity to the virus. There are other medical treatments that yield fruitful results against COVID, such as ivermectin, vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, and boosted immune systems for flu and colds. Nuremberg Code number 3. Base experiments on results of animal experimentation and natural history of disease. This gene therapy skipped animal testing and went straight to human trials in an mRNA research that Pfizer used, a candidate study on mRNA with rhesus macaques, monkeys, using BNT162B2 mRNA. And in that study, all the monkeys develop pulmonary inflammation, but the researchers considered the risk low as there were young, healthy monkeys from the ages of 2 to 4. Israel has used Pfizer, and the International Court of Law has accepted a claim for 80% of the recipients having pulmonary inflammation from being injected with this gene therapy. Despite this alarming development, Pfizer proceeded to develop their mRNA for COVID without animal testing. Nuremberg Code number 4, avoid all unnecessary suffering and injury. Since the rollout of the experiment and listed under CDC VAERS reporting system, Over 4,000 deaths and 50,000 vaccine injuries have been reported in America. In the EU, over 7,000 deaths and 365,000 vaccine injuries have been reported. This is a grievous violation of this Nuremberg Code. Nuremberg Code Number 5, no experiment can be conducted if there's reason to think injury or death will occur. C Number 4, based on fact-based medical data, this gene therapy is causing death and injury. Past research on mRNA also shows several risks that have been ignored for this current trial gene experiment. A 2002 study on SARS-CoV spike proteins showed they cause inflammation, immunopathology, blood clots, and impede angiotensin II expression. This experiment forces the body to produce the spike protein inheriting all these risks. Nuremberg Code Number 6, risk should never exceed the benefit. COVID-19 has a 98 to 99% recovery rate. The vaccine injuries, deaths, and adverse side effects of mRNA gene therapy far exceed the risk. The use of leaky vaccines were banned for agriculture use by the United States and EU due to the Merrick chicken study that shows hot viruses and variants emerging, making the disease even more deadly. Yet this has been ignored for human use by the CDC, knowing fully the risk of new, deadlier variants emerge from leaky vaccinations. Nuremberg Code Number 7, preparation must be made against even remote possibility of injury, disability, or death. There were no preparations made. This gene therapy was approved under an Emergency Use Only Act, skipped animal and human trials, and forced on a misinformed public. Nuremberg Code Number 8, experiment must be conducted by scientifically qualified persons. Politicians, media, and actors claiming that this is a safe and effective vaccine are not qualified. Propaganda is not medical science. Many retail outlets, such as Walmart, drive-through vaccine centers, are not qualified to administer experimental medical gene therapies to the uninformed public. Nuremberg Code Number 9, anyone must have the freedom to bring the experiment to an end at any time, despite the outcry of over 85,000 doctors, nurses, virologists, epidemiologists. The experiment is not being ended. In fact, more attempts to change laws to force vaccine compliance mandatory and force vaccinations are being pushed through, and experimental update shots are planned for every 6 months without any recourse to the surmountable amount of deaths and injuries already caused by the experiment. Hopefully, this new Nuremberg trial will put an end to this crime against humanity. Nuremberg Code Number 10. The scientists must bring the experiment to an end at any time if there's probable cause of it resulting in injury or death. It is clear in that statistical reporting data that this experiment is resulting in death and injury, yet all the politicians, drug companies, and so-called experts are not making any attempt to stop this gene therapy experiment from inflicting harm on a misinformed public. What can you do to help to this crime against humanity? Share this information. Make your politicians, media, doctors, nurses inform that if they are complicit in this crime against humanity, they too are subject to the law set forth in the Geneva Convention and Nuremberg Code and can be tried, found guilty, and put to death. Legal proceedings are moving forward. Evidence has been collected, and a large growing body of experts are sounding the alarm. Visit the COVID Committee website at corona-ausschuss.de. It's Corona, C-O-R-O-N-A. AUSS, like Sam, AUSSCHUSS.DE. Corona-Ausschuss.DE. And if you have been affected by this crime, report the event, persons involved, and as much detail to the following website, linked to www.securewhistleblower.com. www.securewhistleblower.com. Crimes against humanity affect us all. They are a crime against you, your children, your parents, your grandparents, your community, and your country, and your future. And why social media and MSM is suppressing this information is very disturbing to me, and I hope to you. So go on Algora, ALGORA.com, and read the article and get the websites. And if you or you know of someone who has been injured or died after the jabs, report it. The article is entitled WHO and CDC - The New Nuremberg Trials 2021 - Dr. Rainer Fulmich, Crimes Against Humanity, dated May 8, 2021. Algora blog, ALGORABLOG, Algora blog. So listen up and do the right thing and stop these crimes against Americans and crimes against humanity around the world. If a pregnant woman has the right to control her own body, under the United States Constitution and the approval of the United States Supreme Court, then every individual in America has the right to control their own body and not be assaulted with a needle filled with chemicals and unknown consequences, immediate, short, or long-term, because there are no long-term case studies, so that in the future, if people begin to drop dead from heart attacks, strokes caused by blood clots and inflammation and brain injuries and profusely bleeding or sterility or paralysis or whatever happens to them, there will be no way to link that trial and experimental vax to those deaths and injuries without published long-term case studies, in my opinion, unethical and immoral on the direct adverse health effects to human beings. No doctor, not Dr. Fauci, not Bill Gates, not CDC directors, not WHO directors, not Joe Biden, nobody can tell you that you will not be directly suffer a direct adverse health effect once they plunge that needle into your arm, using you as a piece of chattel, property, commodity, for profit, and for human capital for their experiments and their trials. And on that note, I want to say God bless you and God bless all Americans and people around the world. And I also want to say, remember, injustices can happen to you and they can happen to me. But together we can make a positive difference. Remember that you are never alone when you tune in to Colombo Chronicles every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the good old West Coast. So stay healthy, stay happy, and remember, I love you and God loves you.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.